Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 49. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrand. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you The Girl from Samarkand by E. Hoffman Price, narrated by James Silverstein. Fans of the show will have heard E. Hoffman Price's biography twice before, so I'll keep this short. Edgar Hoffman Trooper Price was a prolific contemporary of Lovecraft's who contributed to a large number of pulp magazines. Born July 3, 1898, Price died June 18, 1988, and we've previously run his stories Live Bait in Episode 9 and The Devil's Crypt in Episode 45. James Silverstein writes for role-playing games and loves to participate in his local community theatre. He contributed to The Rapier's Edge for 7th Sea and False Gods for the Stargate SG-1 RPG. He is also currently writing for the upcoming fantasy RPG Khan. His gift for writing is ironically his curse in the world of gaming. He never gets to play because everyone wants to share in his imagination. So make yourself comfortable on that beautiful Persian carpet over there. This is The Girl from Samarkand by E. Hoffman Price, narrated by James Silverstein.
As her guest set the dainty bone china cup on the onyx-topped teak tabouret and sank back among the embroidered cushions, Diane knew to the syllable the words which were to filter forth with the next breath of smoke. For 3 years as Hammersmith's clerk wife had convinced her that the remark was inevitable. "My dear, wherever did you get those perfectly gorgeous rugs?" And Diane, true to form, smiled ever so faintly and luxuriated in the suspicion of a yawn. The ennui of an odalisque hardened the magnificence of a seraglio carpeted with an ancient Farragan rug and hung with silken witcheries from the looms of Kashan. Diane saw the wonder permeate her friend's soul and heard it surge into words. "The rugs? Why, well, I married them along with Ham, you might say. Yes, they are rather pretty, aren't they? But they're an awful pest at times." "Naturally," agreed Louise, who lived in a loft in the Pontalba building, where she could look down into the plaza where Jackson reins in his brazen horse and lifts his brazen hats in salutation to the French Quarter of New Orleans. "You simply couldn't let the maid clean." "Maid? Lord help us, but I daren't touch them myself. I tried once. That heaven-sent prayer rug," Diane indicated an ancient Geordie's, a cease green splendor worth more than his right eye to any collector, "looked a bit dingy." "And Ham caught me at it?" "What was left of my hair fell short of a close shingle. Do you know, one day I caught him filling the bathtub with milk?"
"What?"
"Precisely. Seems some expert claimed a milk bath improves the luster. So the little Bokhara, that blood-red creature beneath y'all feet, got a treatment fit for a Circassian beauty. I'm just waiting for him to bring home a duster of bird-of-paradise plumes for this venerable wreck." Diane stroked what was left of the peach-blow sapphire and gold nap of an age-old senna woven on a silken warp. "The truth of it is," continued Diane, "I feel guilty of bigamy. The man was married to his rugs long before he ever met me. Remember how we speculated on the pros and cons of polygamy the other day at Arno's? Well, here I am, one lone woman competing with a dozen odd favorites, and a new rival added to the harem every so often."
"Good Lord, Diane, what next? You are unique. Why, one would think you were jealous of them."
"Well, I am. Outlandish as that fantastical husband of yours, I don't know which is the more outre. His mania for these beautiful things with the impossible names, or your... heavens above, it does really seem like resentment against them." "Now, if you'd married Peter," Louise laughed metallically,
He'd never have given you time to be jealous of a rug.
That's just it, flared Diane. I could forgive flirtations and black eyes and a reasonable degree of non-support, but these damned rugs, look at that.
Diane dug her cobra skin toe into the closely worn nap of the Farragut carpet.
Look at it. Just a rug the first time.
But you live with it day after day. See the witchery sparkling at sunset. Catch yourself losing yourself in the thrill of its 300 years, wondering that all the ecstasy ever lost in the entire world could be imprisoned in a rug. Then you see your one and only and otherwise adequate husband sitting of an evening, hours at a stretch, staring at it, and dreaming of all the richness and glamour he's lost through becoming civilized, learning to wear shoes and having only one woman, and she his wife, about the house. Yes, I called you up to have you listen to me get the indignation out of my soul. The truth of it is, Lou, that if I don't get out of this atmosphere soon, I'll go utterly mad. Someday I'm going to move in on you in your attic. Anything to get away from all this.
Do you mean to say, began Louise with wide-spaced deliberation, that you'd actually leave Ham because he likes to mess and poke around with his rugs and spend most of his waking moments talking about them? Honestly, now, good Lord, I could stand his talking about them, but...
Diane shuddered.
Lou, he loves them. Sits there, transfigured, like a saint contemplating the dewdrop glistening in the lotus cup.
When I suggested over at the Iron Gate that you move in with me, I didn't know that you were married. They all call you La Belle Livadaise, and you were the life of everything, and least of all, I never suspected anyone had you enshrined in magnificence like this.
Better think it over, Di. I've been through the mill, and I know. Diane, from the first, had been fascinated by the exotic atmosphere in which Clark had planted her after the marriage, but in the end, seeing how they had become a part of him, she half-consciously hated them and their everlasting song of Bokhara and Herod of the Hundred Gardens, an unheard song to which Clark listened and replied in unspoken syllables. And thus it was that Diane learned that to live in Clark's apartment would be to become an accessory to those precious fabrics that were his hard-ridden hobby. For no woman would fit into the dim, smoky shadows of that titled salon, unless, bejeweled and daphneously veiled, she could dance with curious paces and gestures beneath the sullen glow of the great brazen mosque lamp, as became the favorite of a Khan in far-off Tartary. From the very beginning, Diane fought to keep her individuality untainted by the overwhelming personalities of those damnably lovely fabrics from Shiraz and the dusty plains of Farragut. And Diane was right, for they dreamed, those old weavers, of the roses of Kirman, of the evening star that danced on the crest of Mount Zagros, of dancing girls in the gardens of Naishapur, of fountains that sprayed mistily in the moonlit valley of Zarab Shan. And all this they wove into what we now learn to catalog as 16th century Persian, or whatever our best guess may be. Into his masterwork, the weaver wove his soul, so that whoever lives with one of these imperishable sorceries that came out of the East must in the end feel its presence, unless he be somewhat duller than the very wood of the loom in which it was woven. Look upon wine as often as you wish, but beware of a Bokhara when it is red, red as the blood of slaughter, red as the embers of a plundered city, a redness charged with the quartered octagons of Turkestan. For in the end, you will become enslaved to the silky splendor that once graced the tent floor of a teak
prince. Diane was right, though Diane never suspected, even dimly, what in the end really did happen to Hammersmith Clark. For naturally enough, neither she nor anyone else saw or heard the yellow girl. That is, no one but Clark. And he saw and heard too much. Had she suspected, but she couldn't have. For who would imagine fate riding to the crossroads in a truck of the American Express Company? It just isn't done. Not until one looks back and sees that it could have happened in no other way. But unheard-of tilings happen in Turkestan. And while one may pause for an evening's glamour beside some moon-kissed fountain in the valley of Zarabshan, and then march on, forgetting, there is that which does not forget, being undying and everlasting. So that, though forgotten, it reaches forth across time and space, not only clinging to the pile of a rug from Samarkand, but resorting even to express truck to carry it the last step towards capturing the forgetful one. All this Diane knew without knowing why she knew, and it seemed so reasonable that there was nothing incongruous in shuddering and saying, as she often had, "I'm afraid of the damn things." As the door clicked behind the departing expressman, Clark clipped the leaden seals of the cylindrical bale, cut its stitching, and thrilled at the thought of the rug he was about to unwrap. For the bale was from Serengian, of New York, who by dint of persistent reaching into the east must have finally succeeded in executing Clark's impossible order. A tawny, golden silkiness smiled from the gaping burlap sheath. Just a glimpse of that wonder in buff and cream, with its four lotus bud border and frets and meanders in blue and coral and peach, told Clark that this, of all things, was as far as possible from what he had ordered Serengian to get, cost what it might. For in place of Persian intricacies in deep wine reds and solemn green, florid magnificence that Isfahan had given to the world before the splendor died, Clark was confronted by an ancient rug from Samarkand. Silken Samarkand in the valley of Zarabshan, thick-napped and luxurious, mysterious with its Mongolian cloud bands and asymmetrical corner pieces, bats and dragons, and five medallion firmaments of blue that could come from none other but the vats of Turkestan. "Good God, it's silk," marveled Clark as he stroked the lustrous pile. "Silk, and by the rod, on a linen warp." He wondered how Serengian could have made that incredible mistake, sending him such a rug in place of what he had ordered. If it were a case of sending something just as good, an unheard-of procedure with that Armenian merchant prince, he certainly had been crafty enough. For no connoisseur who once touched that rich pile, whose eyes were once dazzled by those insouciant colors, whose senses were stricken by the sorcery of the cabalistic designs, could ever return it and say that he had ordered something else. Rather would he thank Serengian for his error. A silk pile on a warp of blue linen, and woven in the days where the Persian Hafiz was called to account by that fierce Mongol for a verse wherein the poet bartered the prince's favorite cities, Samarkand and Bokhara, for the smiling of a Turkey dancing girl and the mole on her left breast. Unbelievable fortune had sent him this incredible rug. And then Clark's wondering, triumphant eyes clouded as he thought of a girl beside whom Samarkand and Bokhara were but the tinkle of brazen anklets. A very long time ago, when there was no Diane, when Clark pursued rugs for that same Serengian who now sought them for Clark. "Egber and Turkey bedest arid dilt mara," muttered Clark,
forgetting all but the glamorous perils that had lured him far into lost cities and high adventure. Hyphus was right. And for a moment the rug from Samarkand, its 5 by 7 feet of tawny silken perfection, putting to confusion the priceless Farragon on which it had been unrolled, gleamed unregarded as Clark's mind whirled to the sonorous accent which the divine Hyphus had enslaved the East and its savage conquerors. Eger an Turki. Strange how after all this time one would remember. It must be that one could never quite forget. The telephone rang, but Clark ignored it until the jangling became too insistent, when he muffled the bell with several towels and a small cushion. Too bad, he apologized as he took the cord from his lounge robe and completed the throttling of the almost stifled annoyance, but I simply cannot be disturbed. In which he was wrong. For to contemplate that wonder from Samarkand was more disturbing than any voice that could creep in over the wire. He fingered the rings of dull, hand-hammered gold that were sewn to one of the salvaged sides. He wondered what palace wall had been enriched by that precious fabric. And with it all came the knowledge that that very rug had been part of his own past. The life that had been knotted into its pile and the sorcery that had been woven into its pattern were speaking to one of Clark's forgotten selves. Yet he was certain that he had never before seen it. For one could never have forgotten such as this, though seen but for an instant. Truly, the rug was a stranger, but the presence that accompanied it was demanding recognition. In the meanwhile, Diane, tired of hearing the operators, "They don't answer," and abandoned her efforts to remind Clark of an engagement. "I wonder," she mused as she finally set aside the useless telephone, "what deviltry my bien-aimé is devising." And then she sought the rendezvous unattended and made the customary apologies for Clark's unaccountable absence. He might have retreated into that dusky inner kingdom from which the very beginning had held against Diane, a silence into which he plunged unaccompanied, not lacking appreciative company, but loving solitude and electing seclusion rather than the sharing of fancies that twisted and the thoughts that writhed in his strange brain. As Diane made her well-rehearsed apologies and frothed behind her vivacious mask, Clark noted the manila envelope that was fastened to the web of the rug from Samarkand and addressed to him, a letter, doubtless, from Sir Ganian. "We regret," wrote the Armenian, "that thus far we have had no success in finding, at any cost, a rug of the weave you ordered. However, we take pleasure in forwarding you this rug, which a caravan stopping at Meshed left with our agent in that city with instructions to forward it to our New York office and thence to you. We are pleased that your agent saw fit to use our facilities for forwarding it to you and wish to congratulate you on having obtained such a priceless specimen. Should you at any time care to dispose of it, be so kind as to give us an option on it, for we are in a position to offer you a better price than any dealer or collector in the United States." The rug itself was improbable enough, but Siriganian's letter, an insoluble riddle. It couldn't be a jest. Then who? True enough, Colonel Marebear's expedition must have passed through Samarand, Yarkand, and Kashgar on its way to the unknown stretches of Chinese Turkestan. But his acquaintance with the colonel was slight, and he had no friends in the colonel's train. And what obscure acquaintance of the wish-you-were-here postcard banality would send a rug which, in the old days, served as a gift from one prince to another? Diane's arrival cut the thread of fancy. "Oh, Ham, but it is gorgeous," enthused La Belle Livadais as she entered the roseate darkness of Clark's studio, and to herself. Another rival.
Then she rehearsed the excuses she had offered for Ham's absence, and hoped he'd absent-mindedly contradict her the first time he deigned to speak for himself. That done, one must consider the latest addition to the seraglio. Clark detailed the story of the rug and its riddle.
"But who in the world would send you such a gift?" wondered Diane.
"Exactly no one, très cher."
"Unless," Diane pointed out, "it might be one of your lost loves in those Asiatic playgrounds you've never entirely left."
Clark laughed, but his derision was unconvincing, and Diane knew that he had been deep in the blackness of Asian nights, knew that her arrival had been an intrusion, that he was but a friendly stranger babbling to her, a friendly stranger of loveliness whose intoxication forced him to speak of it to anyone, even her. The others were bad enough with their everlasting song of Bokhara and Herat of the Hundred Gardens, an unheard song to which Clark listened and replied in unspoken syllables. They were bad enough, they and those monstrous fancies at which time he smilingly expressed with deliberate vagueness, "But this yellow witch from Samarkand." Diane knew that more than a rug had emerged from that bale whose burlap winding sheet still littered the floor. At last it seemed she was intruding on a tete-a-tete, eavesdropping on a monologue, so that when Clark would emerge from his reveries, Diane resented the inevitable thought that he was robbing himself to keep her company. But patience reaches its limits, finally. She saw it one night, twinkle and smile through a lustrous haze that played over its surface, smile the slow, curved smile of a carmine-lipped woman through the veil of her mystery, saw Clark sitting there, eyes shearing the veil and half-smiling in return, a devotee in the ecstatic contemplation of a goddess shrouded in altar fumes.
"Ham!"
"Yes," answered Clark's lips. He had now perfected the trick of having his body act as his proxy.
"Are you taking me to the show tonight?"
"What show?" Clark the Simulacrum stirred lazily in the depths of the cushion-heaped lounge. "The truth of it is, my dear," he resumed after a pause during which some memory of the proposed entertainment must have returned, "truth of it is that I'm awfully busy tonight."
"Busy sitting there staring at nothing and sipping Pernod," flared Diane, the wrath of months flashing forth. Then, as she saw Clark settle back into the depths, "Listen, once and for all, this nonsense has lasted too long. I might as well have married a mummy. Either get that thing out of this house, or I'll leave you to your pious meditations indefinitely."
What?
"Good Lord, Diane, what's this? You heard me. You used to be half human, but now you're utterly impossible. And if you can't show me a little attention, I'm leaving here and now. For the past many weeks, you've acted like a model for a petrified forest, ever since that yellow beast..."
"Yellow beast?"
"Exactly. That damn rung is driving me crazy."
"Is, or has driven," suggested Clark.
"Lies there like a beast of prey, just ready to wake. And you sit there night after night, staring at it until you fall asleep in your chair. Does it go, or do I?"
"What do you want me to do? Throw it away?"
"I don't care what you do with it, only I won't stay in this house with it. It gives me the creeps. You've said entirely too much in your sleep lately. First yellow rugs, and now it's a yellow girl. I'm through."
Clark's brows rose in Saracenic arches. And then he smiled, with a surprising friendliness and a touch of wonder.
"Di, why didn't you tell me sooner? I could understand your craving alligator pears at 3 a.m. I might have understood that, but hating a rug is really a new one on me." "No, stupid, it's nothing like that. I just hate the damn thing, and no more to be said."
"Well, lacking the infallible alibi," Clark glared and assumed his fighting face, "if you mean I choose between you and the rug..."
I'll call a taxi right now.
Don't bother. I'll walk.
The door slammed. Clark twisted his mustache and achieved a laugh. Not merry, but still a laugh. And then he sank back amongst the cushions.
Yellow girl, I thought you were fantastic.
LaVue Carré wondered when the next morning it was rumored that La Belle Livadais had been seen hurrying down St. Peter Street without speaking to any one of the several acquaintances she had met. But when at the Green Shutter in the Old Quarter bookstore it was announced that Diane was living in a loft of the Pontalba building, wonder ceased. For Diane's friend Louise had been no less garrulous than she should have been, so that the habitués of the French Quarter were prepared for the news. And then it was said that to gain admittance to Clark's studio, one must know the code of taps whereby someone who, at times, left a certain side door bearing bottles of Pernod announced his arrival. For Clark answered neither the doorbell nor the telephone. The vendor of Pernod was certainly a discreet person. Yet even a discreet seller of absinthe could see no harm in mentioning that his patron found enormous fascination in watching the play of sunlight and the dance of moonbeams on the golden buff pile of a rug that was more a sleeping, breathing creature than any sane child of the loom. Finally, the courier failed to gain admittance, despite his tapping in code. And this he thought worthy of Diane's ear.
He starves himself, Petit. Since 3 days now he has not admitted me. All the while she lies there, gleaming in the moon, that awful rug. Mon Dieu, it's terrible.
Diane had steadfastly denied that which she had been clamoring for recognition. But when this last bit was added to what had gone before, logic gave way, and Diane's fears asserted themselves. That rug was haunted, was bewitched, was bedeviling Clark. Logic or no logic, that fact was plain. Driven by that monstrous thought, Diane exhumed the little gold key ring and started up Royal Street, determined to cross the barrier before it became impassable. But her determination wavered, and before fitting the well-worn key into the lock, she applied her ear to the keyhole, listened, and heard Clark's voice. Diane resisted the temptation to use her key and stage a scene that even in the imperturbable view care would be sensational for at least a week. Then her pride conquered, and she achieved a most credible smile of disdain.
Sly devil, pretending it was a rug he was so absorbed in.
And since it was but an amorous escapade, Diane's unbelievable speculations were replaced by thoughts reasonable enough not to be terrifying. That very night, Clark was sitting cross-legged on the floor of his studio, full under the red glow of that tall bronze mosque lamp. Before him, shimmering in the moonlight that streamed in through the French windows, lay the rug from Samarkand, mysterious and golden, with its pale sapphire corner pieces glittering like a distant sea viewed through a cleft between two mountain crests. All the witchery and ecstasy that had ever been lost in the entire world were reassembled, pulsating in that silken pile which he contemplated. And this was the night of power, when fate stalked through the corridors of the world like a colossus just risen from an age-old throne of granite, resistless and unconquerable. Clark had spent so many nights and days of staring that it was inevitable that there must be such a night. He saw more than the wonder before him. In place of the marvel woven by deft, forgotten hands, there gleamed enchantingly, as through moon-touched mist, a garden in the valley of Zarabshan. Then came a faint, oddly accented drumming and piping, music to whose tune dead years reassembled their bones and danced forth from their graves, and their ghosts, as they danced, exhaled an overwhelming sweetness that made Clark's brain reel and glow, and his blood surge madly in anticipation of that which he knew must follow. Then, out of the blackness, just beyond the range of the ruddy mosque lamp, and full into the moonlight that marched slowly across the rug, came a slim yellow girl, diaphanously garbed and veiled. Her anklets clicked faintly, and very faint was the tinkle of the pendant that adorned her unusual coiffure. "All these many days I have sought you, my lord," she began, and she extended her arms in welcome. "But in vain, until tonight, when at last I parted the veil and crossed the border." Clark nodded understandingly and looked full into her dark, faintly slanted eyes. "And I have been thinking of you," he began, "ever since someone sent me this rug on which you stand. It is strange how this rug could bridge the gap of 20 years and bring into my very house a glimpse of the valley of Zarab Shan, and stranger yet that you could escape from your father's house and find me here. Though strangest of all, time has not touched you, when by all reason you should be old and leathery and past 40. Yet you are lovelier now than you were then, by that fountain in your garden near Samarkand." "It is not strange," contradicted the yellow girl as she pirouetted with dainty feet across the moon-lapped silk, "for you see me now as I was when I wove my soul into this very rug." Clark smiled incredulously, which was illogical enough, since, compared with the girl's presence, nothing else should be incredible. "How can that be, yellow girl, seeing that we two met one evening 20 years ago, whereas this rug was woven when the great Khan sat enthroned in Samarkand and reproved the Persian Hans for his careless disposal of the great Khan's favorite cities? This was the joy of kings hundreds of years before you and I were born." "Before the last time we were born," corrected the yellow girl. "But the first time, at least, the first time I can recollect. The barred windows of a prince's palace failed to keep you from me, and eunuchs with crescent-bladed scimitars likewise failed. But in the end, why must all loveliness have an end? A bowstring for me, and a sword-stroke for you?" The yellow girl shuddered as she stroked her smooth throat with fingers that sought to wipe off the last lingering memory of a cord of hard-spun silk. "And from the first," continued the girl, "I knew what our doom would be. So I started weaving and completed my task before they suspected us and the bowstring did its work. My soul, myself, being woven cunningly and curiously into silk rich enough to hang on the wall of the Khan's palace, waited patiently and wondered whether you and I could have our day again. Thus it was in the beginning." "Ah, now it does come back to me," interrupted Clark, "as in a dream dimly remembered. How compactly and stiflingly they would wrap me in a bale of silk and carry me past the guards and into your presence, and by what devious routes I would leave you. Yes, and how painlessly swift is the stroke of a scimitar." The yellow girl shuddered. "A scimitar truly wielded is really nothing, after all," continued Clark. "I might have been sawn asunder between planks. Well, and that meeting in the garden these short 20 years ago was after all not our first. It seems that I knew then it was not the first, though but for an evening. Yes, just for an evening. So to what end were we spared bowstrings and the stroke of swift scimitars since we had but an evening?" And thinking of the empty years of luxurious imprisonment that followed, she smiled somberly. "For only an evening.
and then you forgot. Until this rug. This same rug I wove centuries ago interrupted your pleasant adventuring and reminded you. Death stared me in the face, the end of life more vainly lived than the first. I knew that I was leaving this avatar after having lived but one stolen evening. So I sent a trusted servant to carry this very rug to Meshed. For when we met in the garden, you were hunting rugs for him who now seeks them for your delight, and I knew that he would find you if you still lived. Thus it is that I have crossed the border, and stand before you as I did once before, this time on that rye rug which I wove centuries ago, while living in hope of another meeting, and in dread of the bowstring I knew would come in the end to find me. The moon patch had marched towards the end of the rug from Samarkand and was cutting into the blue web at its end. Clark knew that when there remained no more room for her tiny feet, she would vanish, not ever to reappear. But Clark hoped against knowledge. "Yellow girl," he entreated, "my door will be barred to friend and acquaintance alike if you will but return on whatever nights the moon creeps across our rug." Had Diane, listening at the door, understood, she would have used her key. But Diane merely heard, "And I shall wait for those nights as long as life remains in me. For all that has happened since then is nothing and less than nothing, and all has been a dream since that one night in a garden of Zarab Shan." Very little remained of the moon patch. The yellow girl stepped a tiny pace forward to prolong her stay yet another few moments. All but the moonlit strip of the rug from Samarkand glowed bloodily in the flare of the brazen mosque lamp. "No, forgetful lover," eluded the yellow girl. "I cannot return. I cannot cross the border again. In Samarkand 800 years ago we mocked for a while the doom that hung over us, and in the end called the bowstring but a caress of a farewell. Again in the garden of Zarab Shan we met, we parted, and you forgot. So this time I take no chances. While I cannot return, you at least can follow me, if you will. For it is very easy." She edged along the ever-narrowing strip of moon-bathed silk, and with an embracing gesture lured Clark to rise and follow her. "It is so easy. Move lightly, but be careful not to disturb your body or overbalance it." Had Diane not turned away from the door, were she not even now strolling insouciantly down Royal Street? "Yellow girl, you and I have had enough of farewells." Something left Clark. Tottered perilously on the 2 hands' breadths of moonlight that remain, then caught the yellow girl by the hand and took the lead. The blue web of the rug from Samarkand gleamed for another moment in the moonlight, then sweltered in the red glow of the mosque lamp.
That was The Girl from Samarkand by E. Hoffman Price, narrated by James Silverstein. What a remarkable treat. Price summons all the vivid, surreal verbiage he so often poured into horror, and this time around fashions an otherworldly love story that reaches across centuries, cultures, and ultimately even beyond the veil of death itself. Lovely, and a terrific narration from James too, bravo. Like the warp and weft of a beautiful carpet, it's PPP's community that keeps us weaving our weekly tales. And as such, we love hearing from you. Drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click on the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 50, where we'll bring you The Nameless City by H.P. Lovecraft. Remember that even if it really ties a room together, a rug should never trump matrimonial harmony. And have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.